So welcome everyone to the Hey, What's Up with Pelgrane Press panel, in which we explain, hey, what's up with Pelgrane Press? I will introduce myself as writer and game designer Robin D. Laws, and our other self-introducing panelists are...
I'm Garth Oderhundrahund, writer and game designer too.
And my name is Rob Hainso. I am the American ringer. 13th age is mainly my thing for these guys.
I'm Kenneth Hite, writer and game designer and podcaster.
I'm Kat Tobin, and I'm the co-owner and managing director.
I'm Simon Rogers, co-owner of Pelgrane Press.
So I guess one of the big bits of news from last year is that Pelgrane now has co-owners.
So
That was afterwards, wasn't it? Yes.
Yeah.
We didn't talk about it.
It was certainly after last year.
Yeah. So, Kat, perhaps you could kick off by describing your new understanding of Pelgrane and the gaming industry now that you are a co-poobah of Pelgrane.
Describe your ascent to power.
Yes.
I'm going to be interested to hear. Yeah.
I really wasn't expecting to have to answer that.
But you let me moderate, so that's what happened.
I did let you moderate. Clearly that was my first mistake. And mostly what I've learned is not to let you moderate panels.
You learned that just now.
Just now, exactly. I'm constantly growing and evolving in my new role as co-owner and co-grand poobah. Am I half grand poobah? Co-grand
poobah? Grand poobah is
fine.
Poobish.
Yes.
It's like the kings of Sparta. There's technically two.
So rather than answer that vague question, why don't you tell them about your exciting new project that you have in front of you?
So my newest project, literally finished as of Tuesday, is Seven Wonders, which is a story games anthology. It's featuring some fantastic UK-based games designers who I'm going to spring on they call from the audience to talk about their games. So I can see Liz and Becky first. So do you want to go first? One of you? Go on, Becky. You can do it.
I'm Becky. So I have a game in the anthology. Thank you very much to Kat. My game is called When the Dark is Gone. It came out of two design challenges that I set myself, which was firstly, can you create a game which runs in 2 to 4 hours, which is emotionally engaging, as in you emotionally get attached to your character? And the second design challenge I set myself was, can I write a game which has no conflict resolution mechanic? And I think I've achieved both of those things. And both of those were actually resolved, if you like, by a very specific setting. When the Dark is Gone is a game set in a therapy session. And the people in therapy are, for example, the children who went to Narnia and had all of their adventures. Participated in a war, grew up to become kings and queens, and then came back home and went back to maths homework and wartime rations. And I thought, well, what would a therapy session with those children look like? And the advantages of this are you have a therapist character like the GM, and they can really help the players delve into the emotions of their characters in a very short space of time. And because it's a therapy session and the characters are recounting their memories of what happened, if their memories conflict, well, memories just do. And how we deal with that? Well, how do we deal with it in the real world? By talking and working through our issues together. So that was When the Dark is Gone.
Liz, do you want to go next?
I'm Liz Hudbo. My game is called Rise and Fall, and it's about building and living in and then destroying dystopias. And the process of writing actually came out of writing a much more traditional GM'd tabletop game of my own dystopia of my own making. And the process that I went through in the beginning of that, kind of asking myself questions about how does this dystopia work? I knew what the dystopia looked like, but I kind of didn't know how to get there. So I had this list of questions, and I thought, hang on a minute, this is the question, this is a game in its own right. So the game runs in three phases, the first of which you build your dystopia up, starting from some sort of agreed base point with the whole series of things going badly wrong in various ways. And then there's a phase where you live under the dystopia, see how people cope with the various pressures that they're under. And then at the end, we bring it all down again and hopefully build something more glorious and more lovely afterwards.
Thank you.
So, Kat, could you talk a little bit about the whole project and your what inspired you to do it and what the process of recruiting the designers was?
I'll just do that super quickly because I would like to talk back to some other people.
I didn't realize. I thought we had more than, okay.
Yeah, right. No, there are seven people.
But it's all seven are here?
So, yeah, so I'll just jump to Tony. All seven aren't here, so we'll keep it.
All right. My name is Tova Naslund, and I wrote the Acceptable Losses game. It's about family relationships and what you're willing to sacrifice for your family. When you live in a dystopian future where family is all you have to survive your everyday life. And it's about tough choices, about personal sacrifice, and that's it. Thank you.
And you can see Joanna down there as well.
I'm Joanna Cancastelli. I wrote the game Full Storm, which is basically, I wanted to write a game where you could play a full fantasy campaign in an evening. So it starts with a traditional adventuring party of characters sat together around the fire on the eve of their final battle. So this is the longest breath before the Battle of Heaven or Fields or something like that, where all the characters sit around together and flash back into their story so you can find out how they got to this point. And deal with all of the problems that have grown up between them over this time with stealing each other's money and that kind of thing, as happens with traditional fantasy parties. So yeah, that's fantasy campaign in one.
Awesome, thank you. Lynn is here, she can't see her. Okay, cool. Yeah, so thanks very much. So the process, basically, something that I was talking to somebody on the booth about earlier, is that obviously we're a British-based role-playing company, and it's quite important, I think, certainly for me, that we kind of support the British games industry where we can. And I think that part of that is kind of fostering and developing new talent in the British games industry. So that's kind of where the commission came from. Also, I love story games, and I came across Becky's When the Dark Has Gone, fell completely in love with it, and went, how can we make a book out of this? Where can we get more things for this? And that's where the commission for it came from.
And so are you going to trick some of these talented designers into writing more stuff for Pelgrane's established lines?
Well, duh. But I haven't told them that. Spoiler.
And this book is released today here. There are the writers here who can sign it. So come and buy it afterwards.
So I guess the other huge thing is that the Dracula dossier and director's handbook are finally here. I think for many years we've been discussing the process of putting it together. Now, how done is it now?
The director's handbook is done and in print and on the table. Dracula Unredacted is done and unredacted and in print and on the table. Edom Files, which are the adventures spanning 1877 to the War on Terror, so Russo-Turkish War to the War on Terror. We aren't quite able to get into the second Russo-Turkish War, which is beginning as we speak. But maybe if it goes into a second printing. We have Edom Files. Those the adventures are done and they are in production. Yes, art is being
art is all done.
Art is artist.
So we just need maps now.
Maps need to be mapped. And the Edom Field Manual, which is the sort of three books in one. It is an invoice copy of the actual briefing instructions that you get when you become a raiding with Operation Edom and are sent out to hunt vampires on very little information and no bureaucratic support. It is also the player's guide. So if you are playing a campaign in which you are playing the vampire hunting secret service of Her Majesty, you can build out that campaign and play within it. And then there is finally the director's guide to running Edom and all the details and NPCs and things like that. And that has all been put together and written by Gar and touched by me just enough to get my name in the credits. And then it is producted and arted?
It is all arted and mostly producted.
Mostly producted.
Pretty much, yeah, it's good to print.
And what's the status of the wax cylinder?
The Wax Cylinder recording is up for backers. They can listen to it. It was in a backer report this month.
And for the benefit of those who don't know what the heck I'm talking about, what is the wax cylinder?
The wax cylinder. During the Kickstarter, we had a contest in which, as people backed, they could back either Van Helsing or Mina to reach Castle Dracula and uncover one final clue. And the audience overwhelmingly pretty much chose Mina. Van Helsing was never really in it and wound up, you know, stuck in Prague, I think. And then Mina made it to the castle. And so we reached out to our compendious genealogical database and found a descendant of Mina Harker to record the actual last recording known of Mina Harker, which is now available to you, the players, to play with suitable scritchy sound effects in it.
So it turns out that our former employee, Beth Lewis, is in fact that descendant of Mina Harker. Yes.
Real coincidence, frankly. Yes.
So I guess Ken and Gar, maybe you could go back and forth on this question. If you are an agent of British intelligence sent to hunt vampires, what would be your number one, or your first list of tips for the characters as they go off and do that? What is the best way as a British intelligence agent to go out and hunt vampires?
Gar?
What's your number one tip?
Read Dracula? The initial briefing and the all the clues are in there, you just follow them. Make sure your life insurance is up to date.
Now, does British intelligence take care of you well if you're maimed by a vampire?
Well, much like the GRU, the only way to leave Edom is feet first, or I guess with garlic in your mouth. And so they employ the crippled but still functional employees at various Edom base establishments. But no, it's a short life but a merry one, I think, is the traditional way. And in the Edom Field Manual, there are a number of rotes and TTFBs, tactical fact-finding possibilities and tactical team operation things that are specifically designed for Edom to make operations somewhat survivable. So I think that...
And there are plenty of not at all suspicious red liquids being injected into your body to give you convenient vampire super strength and so forth, which never have any long-term effects or don't like.
Yes,
you know,
they're combat drugs, but if you find yourself nervous in churches after taking them, then just it's just a good advice to avoid Holy Communion at any time while taking the combat drugs.
Now, speaking of undead entities who devour your will, Gar, Ken has been training you to think like Ken. Can you describe the process of learning to think like Ken while working on the Dracula dossier?
You learn to see that everything is connected to everything else if you just work hard enough at it. So you take any random fact and you delve into it, and pretty soon it ends up being connected to either the occult or spies or both. Because basically every historical figure is where they can tell was working at some point for British intelligence, or the Russians, or someone similar, or both. And it crops up in the weirdest places as well. Anything connected to MFI within about three steps, like the Kevin Bacon of the mysterious underworld.
And I should also mention that The Thrill of Dracula, which is my analysis of the Dracula story as told and retold mostly in film since 1897, is in final writing even now.
And Hawkins' papers as well, our giant file of handouts, is all arted and done and in production. All I think it can is like finding flies to squish for the Renfield papers.
Yep. That slowed us down because there aren't as many flies in the winter.
Indeed.
So to switch gears for a bit, another of Palgrain's major lines is 13th Age. And Rob, you're the man to talk about that. What has recently happened for 13th Age, and what is about to happen for 13th Age?
Let's see. Most recently, there's a Battle Scenes book, which is, I think the verb that's now being used here is arted, and it's about to start being productive.
It's been roted.
It's been roted and developed.
Can we get somebody to English it?
Yeah. The development is done. And,
it's a pain when there's already a perfectly good verb.
Yeah, it really
wrecks the pattern.
Problem. Okay, so High Magic and Low Cunning is ready to go, I believe, next week. I think I'm going to get a couple pieces of art revised, but other than that, it's ready.
And what is that?
Callum Moore wrote battle scenes for all 13 icons, and the idea is that you can take mini adventures and plug them into a campaign. If you have a campaign that's about the Emperor or the Orc Lord or the Barbarian, you'll find a set of 2 to 4 little battles and vignettes that can either just be inserted into any campaign, or that you can start a campaign using them. And the idea is the first book is 5 icons, Orc Lord, Archmage, High Druid, the 3, and the Prince of Shadows. And there's ideas for how you can use them for other ones. I think it's an adventure book, unlike Eyes of the Stone Thief, which is a monumental novel of an adventure book. This is a deliberate short story anthology of adventures, and pretty happy with it. It has a lot of monsters. I think most GMs are going to find something to run, but even if you don't, it has an awful lot of interesting ideas that can be plundered. There are other books in that line coming. The next one is probably High Crown, The Crown Commands, which is all the people who sound like they're emperors, lich kings, elf queens, and dwarf kings. And then the last one is Your Faith Will Set You on Fire. Hey, I just said the name out loud, so maybe we'll use it, but I'm not sure that we're going to go with that. Yeah, we'll see. Anyway, so Your Faith Will Set You on Fire is battle scenes for all the people, all the icons who are somehow faith-based. These books will probably, I suspect they may all come out this year. We're certainly working on the other two right now to get them done.
Next year.
Yeah,
I'm sorry. Yeah, 2016. and that's what I mean by this year. Yeah, I'm looking at
this Dragon Meet year.
Yeah.
Before Dragon Meet.
In the next 3 weeks, all of this.
And if it's not, write to Rob.
Okay, that's good. Other things that have happened are that the very first adventure book for 13th Age, which has a cover but has never come out, has now, if you drew a graph of its size, it would be like here. Here, and now it's at a size that Simon actually wants to publish it. and I suspect that all the other pieces of it will show up in other places. So Stars of the Broken Sky will also be out pretty soon. I feel rather odd about the 13th Age line in the sense that there are all these exciting books, we haven't announced them yet, and many of them are in roted. the writement has occurred.
Rightation.
Rightation. There we go. And there's some development to be done, the art process. But so the odd thing is I think that there are four books that are pretty much written now, and that therefore it's just the process of production is going to be happening in the next few months. We'll see how many of those get out. In the near future, I guess.
And so the big thing on your plate, design-wise, is 13th Age and Glorantha.
Yeah, 13th Age and Glorantha is the project that I'm not doing for Pelgrane, but one of the interesting... 13th Age and Glorantha has now reached that crucial 80% done spot, where the last 20% is going to be fun, challenging, and why is it that last 20% taking so long? Yeah, anyway, so... one of the things that Simon is interested in having us do is there are going to be some character class books, or at least one, probably others, coming out from Pelgrane. And I have to admit that doing 13th Age and Glorantha, when you get a second bite on a system, you've learned a lot. And so the things that are happening in that game work really well for 13th Age. And, you know, there are character classes that accomplish things that some 13th Age classes were meant to do and maybe didn't do quite as well as I would have liked them to. So in some cases that you'll just want to take 13th Age, Glorantha, Berserker, or the Trickster and adapt them into Dragon Empire games. And in other cases, I think that I'm actually going to do work with some other designers and explore the concepts that came out of the Glorantha book and bring them back into new stuff that fits more into the style of the Dragon Empire books. So that'll probably be happening in the first player character class just a sort of the splat book idea of taking two or three classes and doing cool things for them.
So is there a particular example of a thing that you've developed for Glorantha that you are thinking of having a porting back into 13th Age?
Yeah. When we did one of the things we did when we did 13th Age is we made some very simple classes with the idea that you could, if you have a person who really doesn't want to do anything other than roll the dice, go ahead and give them a barbarian, maybe give them a paladin. Of course, there's an awful lot of people who play barbarians and paladins in the history of these fantasy games who are a bit disappointed by playing a character that's that simple. They're sort of like, well, I'd like to be like the other kids and do interesting things all the time. And so the Glorantha is a world full of barbarian types, worshipping barbarian gods, swinging bronze swords, and we're doing couple transformations.
There's this guy named Orlanth you may have heard of.
Yeah, Orlanth, and then there's the trolls who definitely have people who, you know, troll warriors feel a lot like barbarians. What we're doing is we're doing taking the idea of, okay, let's use a bunch of the barbarian class stuff, but then let's put new features on it that make it more interesting to play and give you more choices. I think that for the Berserker is an example of a kind of class that appears random because you're rolling a die to find out what power you can use, except that there's always choices in the roll, and the choices are ones you set up with power choices at the beginning, and they either affect your character long term or just a quick burst of power, and you're making that choice. So it turns out that that style of apparent randomness that actually is really interesting to play is the kind of thing I would like to have barbarian style characters in the Dragon Empire also use. So we'll be adopting both of those ideas probably in a character class book aimed at barbarians.
Gar, do you want to talk about demons?
This is almost done, right?
It's like three quarters plus done.
Wrote it.
The Rotten and Green Dealing is happening. Demons, or demons, or the Book of Demons, or whatever way they're calling it.
We could have a poll right now.
I want the D6 table in the back of the book, like you.
Other names.
Exactly.
Yeah, okay, all right.
Basically, it's a short little Book of Loot-sized supplement on demons and hellholes and demonic things. There will be a demonologist character class in there, which specializes in summoning demons, which the necromancer specializes in having undead running around the place. And the bulk of the book is basically write-ups of five or six different new hellholes with their own unique demon denizens and adventure scenes for those, and magic items, and GMing demons and icon stuff. And it'll be a cute little sort of palate cleanser after Dracula Dossier.
Get some demons into your mouth and swish them around.
Pretty much, yeah.
Yeah.
So
for 13th Age, the MO is always to take a beloved D&D / F20 trope and put a new spin on it. So what is a demon in the 13th Age setting?
Well, the nice thing about demons is that they're so absolutely flexible. I mean, they are the most... Like, every other monster, pretty much, has a particular theme or particular habitat or particular goal. Demons, you can sort of plug it anywhere. They're like the tofu of monsters.
Now I'm terrified.
That's right.
You take vegetarians.
you take demons, and you put them in there, and they absorb flavor from things around them. And then go into the future. If you want a subtle game of urban investigation, you can be sort of fight scene at the end. You get this game where you're trying to track down this evil demonologist, identify him, and then when you finally find him, he goes, aha, brah, as demon beings spring up and you go fight them in this practical fight scene. If you want a demon army attacking a town, demons can do that. If you want psychological horror, if someone possessed by demons or haunted by them, they fit in everywhere. So basically it's been part of the basically you making sure that demons are always a coherent concept, not just like a random evil. While it's observing their wonderful ability to be used by pretty much any villain you can think of demons will always be them.
Right. So as the tofu of monsters, basically the most terrifying thing about them is that they'll corner you at a party and tell you all about their new conversion to veganism. That's what I'm picking out of that.
Veganism and destroying the world, yeah.
Veganism and CrossFit.
Yeah. Not necessarily in that order.
So one of the things I like about the demon book is that we were talking about doing a sort of a product that was like followers for the icons. Envisioning that as like a book that had multiple icons in it. But what's really happening, partly as a consequence of like the book that you're doing, and partly of the way of approaching the Archmage, each of the icons sort of deserves their own approach. So you know, the book that you're doing is about a lot about the Diabolist.
Yeah.
The Crusader,
but Diabolist is very much front and center.
And so then another book working on is a book really about the Archmage and the strange people you wouldn't expect who are involved with him, who follow him, who and are basically monster stats for non-player characters. Because one of the things we didn't really give is, here's what wizard schools look like, here's what a whole legion of emancipated familiars looks like if they're like pulling the strings behind the world. And what we're not going to, it's not a situation where we have to do a line of every single icon gets this style of cookie cutter approach. The books are going to be totally different. It is just going to have to be that one is about the Diabolist, one is about the Archmage. We'll see who gets the next one.
So, Simon, 2016, mm-hmm. particularly 2016 at Gen Con, is going to be a giant year for Gumshoe because it will be the 10th anniversary of Gumshoe. It'll be 10 years since the time when you and I sat at one little table in the Gen Con Exhibitors Hall with some Dying Earth stuff and a copy of the brand new little slim original version of Esoterrorists. And it's gotten bigger since then. And 2016 Gumshoe is going to have a banner year of stuff. So maybe you could give an overview of what that stuff is. And those of us who are routining some of that stuff will then go into more detail on particular things.
The second book we released in the line was Fear Itself, which was partly inspired by Dave Alsop's unremitting horror setting. And it's a very solid game, but it's more sketchy than some of the others. And because of all the development that we've had and all the feedback from players over the years and the stuff that's all ended up in Esoterrorist 2, we're now better prepared to create a game that's much more crafted for the different kinds of games of individual horror that you can play. So Gareth is rewriting and creating a second edition of Fear Itself, which will feature campaign frames for the different kinds of horror genres. So your slasher fiction, your literary horror, and each one will be crafted so that it delivers that experience at the table. And so that's the first one that we're working on. The second one is Ken's big project for this coming year, which is Fall of Delta Green. Do you want to talk about that?
Yeah. Fall of Delta Green is the... let's just back up briefly. Delta Green is the finest campaign setting ever done for Call of Cthulhu by a long chalk. And it was done way back in the ancient times of the 90s by Pagan Publishing, and now has been revived as a new standalone role-playing game reminiscent of Call of Cthulhu by Greg Stolze and Scott Clancy and Shane Ivey, and it will be released by Arc Dream in the coming year. They asked what Pelgrane would like to do to sort of, as the other sort of best of breed Cthulhu guys, what we would like to do to help out with the Delta Green world, and after some back and forth, we decided that we would do a standalone Delta Green in the 1960s campaign, or a core book. So you can play Delta Green agents in the 1960s during the time when Delta Green was the authorized U.S. government anti-mythos task force. And you can play from their brand new beginnings in the New Frontier all the way up to their self-destruction in the jungles of Indochina in 1970. We'll cover the whole rise and fall of Delta Green, but specifically the fall. And the good thing about the 1960s is that it's a very exciting, evocative historical period. It hasn't been done to death by everybody else. And we have lots and lots of sort of thematic material from the actual history and culture of the decade, because if you were to pick a decade that was Lovecraft's idea of the apocalypse, the 1960s are it. And so I think that we can get a lot of good thematic juice out of that. It'll be a standalone. It'll be as compatible with Night's Black Agents and Trail of Cthulhu as we can stand to make it. It will be a faithful translation of the Delta Green core rules. So there will be rules for what organization you're in that will have a mechanical salience as you play at the table. Also, the bonds that you have with other non-player characters that you fry in order to stay barely capable of doing your job, that will be a big present part of the game as well. So it's going to be a great deal of fun to do. It, I believe we have one supplement in the license, which will probably be a Book of Adventures, but I'm not sure. But right now it's just a matter of getting Trail of Cthulhu, only Delta Green, only the 1960s, and shorter.
So the next big Gumshoe innovation was an idea that Pat proposed, which was Gumshoe 1-to-1, I think a lot of design and development work has gone into that to allow one player and one GM to experience an investigative scenario, which in fiction is far more common than groups of people getting together and investigating things. Do you want to talk
about? So that's, I'm the designer of Gumshoe 1-to-1, which is a rethink of the Gumshoe system for that format, one GM, one player. And it turns out people are very excited about this, that it's an unaddressed niche. And there are a lot of people, for example, who want to use it to, I just want something to run for my wife or my husband. And sometimes I want to introduce them to gaming through this. And even Ken's wife has expressed an interest in having this game run for her, which is an epic-changing event. and so there's a lot of things that you just sort of take for granted in group-based role-playing rules that actually aren't pertinent or useful when you play one-to-one. So, and a lot of standard Gumshoe is about dividing spotlight time between players. Well, you want exactly the opposite because there's only one player, so you have to. So it sets up mechanisms to allow you to, for example, have a character who has a reasonable spread of skills and then a group of contacts that they go to when they need specialized information. And depending on what genre of detective story you're telling, that would differ. But in the case of the setting that comes with the core book, it's our Cthulhu confidential setting. It's a Trail of Cthulhu style mystery in 1937 Los Angeles. So it's our film noir, hard-boiled detective setting in the real and really weird Los Angeles. And so the first, the core book comes packaged with an adventure. One of the things about that I've discovered about this in the process of doing it is that even more than regular Gumshoe, it really helps to have a very tightly written but not railroady scenario, because when you're running for one person as a GM, you don't have the time to think and improvise that you would ordinarily have in a multiplayer game, because what you omit from that experience is the chunk of time spent discussing or sometimes arguing among the players as to what to do next. And that's the time when the GM has the opportunity to sit back and go, okay, well, if they go here, I'll do this, and that's actually, that thing they're talking about is a better idea than the one in the scenario, so I'll change it to this. That, because both the GM and the player are constantly on screen, it's a more intense experience for both of them. And for the GM, you need a tighter, more in-depth adventure, and so the adventures turn out to be somewhat longer than I anticipated them being, but it also makes them a lot more fun to read. And so the in the process of playtesting, so that rather than having one person come over to my house to run the game for them, I played online using the Roll20 format, and it works extremely well for remote play, because the difficulty of running a standard game on Google Hangout, which is time managing everybody's spotlight time when they're not physically present, is eliminated because it's just a one-on-one thing. And so to playtest it, I actually had the fun of running it first for Simon and then for Kat. And so which one of you wants to describe the experience of playing Gumshoe 1-to-1 without giving away the plot of the adventure.
Yeah, well, without going into any sort of details about the plot or anything, it's an incredibly different play experience to anything I've ever played before. Because, like Robin mentioned, you become used to working as part of a party, and so you know you tend to turn to the person next to you and go, oh, "What do you think we should do now?" You know, I think maybe we should do this, but you expect more input from the other players, and you don't have that in 1-to-1. So like Robin was kind of sitting there going, "Right, so what are you doing now?" And I was like, "Anyone? No? I guess I'll just go here then." And it's a lot more intense. I found as an investigative experience. I don't know if that was how you found it.
It was really very much like an interactive novel. You did really feel that you were participating in a narrative.
Yeah.
I mean, the fact that it's the first thing of Robin's I've done where I haven't seen it written down. It was experiencing the adventure as a pass through a narrative, and then obviously when you see it written down, you then work out how Gumshoe actually functions. But I got to a point in the game where I was with one monitor, I was typing out all the clues and information, and I felt I was stuck, that there was nowhere for me to go. And I thought, well, this is Gumshoe, clearly there is. And I worked out that it involved me going to see Mickey Cohen, who's like a terrifying gangster. The only reason I was blanking that out was because
I did not
want to go and talk to Mickey Cohen. But actually, there was a lead.
Yeah, you don't want
to. So I did go to talk to him, and it worked out okay-ish.
and the other thing about Gumshoe 1-to-1 is that you can write things that don't have to be gigantic to terrify the player, because just being alone in a garage with a multiplayer game would be, oh yeah, these are just small standard lines. Well, you're just there by yourself, and there's, you know, to name an example that isn't any of the adventures, there's one deep one, but you're just one person alone. That actually then becomes really scary, and you don't have a backup or...
And in terms of the other settings we're going to provide, the Robin's default character will be in the core book, and either in the core book or in a closely or simultaneously released other setting, we have Chris Spivey, who will be producing an African-American archivist in Washington, D.C., which just sounds fantastic. And Ruth Tillman has just pitched, Franny Fisher?
Franny Fisher Murder Mysteries.
Right, with the licensing issues filed off.
Vivian Sinclair.
She's not Franny Fisher.
Yeah. Let's just say she fishes, and she may or may not also be Franny.
Right.
And if it goes well, there's so many different potential settings.
Yeah, I want to do Karnacki for it, for example.
And there's also and I've also already turned in three more of the adventures for the Cthulhu Confidential Dex Raymond character. So there will be follow-up there, because if it's a system that requires or rewards tighter adventures, we want to make sure that we have them for you right away, rather than what sometimes happens is you release a core book and then there's a big space before additional adventures coming out, and Gumshoe 1-to-1 won't work if we do that, so we're not going to do that.
Now there are other projects for Gumshoe, Trail of Cthulhu projects. The first one is a Trail of Cthulhu starter boxed set, which will probably kickstart, but it will include the core Gumshoe rules and basically the core trail rules, but introduced in a way that it feels like a board game. Because having played some of these anthology games with people who've never ever played a role-playing game, they were saying, "Oh, I can play this game with my family at Christmas, but there are no little counters or bits of card or whatever, so it doesn't feel quite right." So to produce it as a box set makes it give it a board game introductory feel, like a kind of almost like a tutorial that talks the GM and the players together through the initial adventure. And then says, "Oh, by the way, you can make stuff up. And this is how you make stuff up." It will be an introduction to role playing, and most of the people who buy will understand, will know a little bit about the mythos. But it will be a really good way of introducing new players in a standalone product. Next up, we have Fearful Symmetries. Steve.
Yeah.
tell the class why you haven't finished it. Well, tell what it is.
Fearful Symmetries is a game in which it's set in the 1930s. You play people who belong to an occult group who discover that magic is real and that you're able to cast spells and gain powers, and then you find out there's a mythos backing to this. And during the campaign, terrible things happen to you, and you do awful things to other people.
And this is a Trail of Cthulhu.
Yeah. This is a Trail of Cthulhu campaign.
Yes. And there's a companion book which Paula Dempsey has completed and delivered. called The Book of the New Jerusalem, which has the same relation to Fearful Symmetries that Book of the Smoke has to Bookhounds of London. And in the same way that Gumshoe 1-1 is absolutely configured for one GM and one player, this is a game that's crafted for a group, an occult group you build at the beginning of the game. And you set what your morality is, what the things you're not willing to do at the beginning of the game.
It's got a lot of support for creating improvised adventures, inspired by the way I've always run improvised adventures, but you might recognise things from Apocalypse World or Dungeon World and the way people do fronts and things like that.
Scott, are you all right? Would you be okay to talk about Poison Tree?
Yes, certainly.
Scott Dorwood.
Hi. So Poison Tree, it's an epic campaign that takes place over about 350 years. It starts off in 17th century rural Wales, and it's about a sort of tainted family bloodline and how it sort of spreads through different eras, different places, all the way through to something fairly cataclysmic in the modern day or near future.
Yes, so I've played in Scott's kind of opening vignette, which was amazing. And then we spent 2 days with Matthew Sanderson at IndieCon running one adventure set at the very opening of the American Revolution, and another one in Sicily after an earthquake. And we're both really, really good.
Quite, really horrific.
Yes, horrific.
In classics.
Yeah.
That's
for
trend.
Yeah.
Yeah.
When's that
due? Yeah, it's a work in progress.
You ask Scott.
I think that's it for Gumshoe stuff at the moment, what I can think of.
So we have very little time left for questions, but we have time for some questions, so who would like to ask a question?
Time watch?
Oh, there we go, time watch. Excellent question, sir.
Yeah. So it's now 300,000 words long, and Kevin, who has a full-time job, it's an extraordinary amount of work to have produced over that time, and the reason that it is horribly delayed is simply because it's about 3 times bigger than we ever thought it would be. The manuscript has been delivered to our copy editor, and it'll take twice as long to edit as we originally planned, and it'll take twice as long to lay out as we originally planned, because it's twice to 3 times as big. But the manuscript's finished.
All the art is
in. The art's all in. I'm not gonna make any promises about when it's gonna be out, but it is an amazing game, it really is. I mean, we had at least 100 seats at Gen Con with people playing it, raving about it. So I'm very, very sorry that it's so delayed. But it will be really, really good when it comes out.
What Simon isn't telling you is that, in fact, they already edited, art directed, and published the book, but that collapsed the time stream. So Kevin had to go back a couple of years in time to make the book twice as big in order to not collapse the time stream. So you're welcome, everybody. Another question.
Any idea when that's going?
We're shooting for Gen Con, right?
Yeah, shooting for Gen Con.
It has been delivered and is being playtested.
Yes, it's about to go out for playtesting any day now, I swear.
When I talked to the Art Dream publishing team at Gen Con, they were really glad that you were doing their Delta Green campaign. But how much of a leeway do you get when you're writing a campaign and it has to fit within the timeline they had already kind of set up?
Well, it's first of all, it's not a campaign. It's a standalone game. It's a core game. But in terms of leeway, I mean, it's just like every other license, right? If I'm doing something within, you know, the Star Trek license, it has to stay within Star Trek. It's just the way the world is. The fact of the matter is that the Delta Green history doesn't actually go in an awful lot of detail as to what's happening in the 1960s. So I have a lot of stuff to play with. You have the general latitude that you always have when you're writing about covert affairs, as we discovered with Dracula Dossier, where you can say, well, that was just, it happened, it just got covered up. And so there's a large degree of latitude, but you know, it's like anything else. The point of writing the book is to make it fit into the Delta Green universe and make it fit into the Delta Green game. Me just going off on a wild tear and deciding that something else happened in the 60s is kind of off mission, so I won't do it. I mean, not like I need to, because the Delta Green story arc already perfectly does what I wanted it to do in the first place, which is why I said the 60s instead of the 50s.
In short, we've kind of been planning this on and off for a long time, and then there was a period of about a week just trying to negotiate things back and forth with extreme goodwill on both sides. But frankly, if it wasn't Ken, they wouldn't have done it, really, because they trust him to know the background, deliver something that enhances the setting, and they've been incredibly reasonable about ownership of IP and so on. But it is the people involved that has made this possible. They wouldn't have done it with almost anybody else, I think.
Is this going to use their like streamlined version?
No, it's going to use Gumshoe. It's a Gumshoe game.
Yeah.
There'll be conversion notes in the back, like there are in the back of Trail for Call of Cthulhu. So. Yes, Steve?
Is there going to be a British angle to the Call of Cthulhu?
I've got to find out from Scott exactly where on the Pisces arc things are.
Okay.
If Pisces is full of Shan, and they have the Ramsey Campbell rights, which I suspect they will by the time the book is out, then it may just get a mention somewhere and say, meanwhile in England, oh my God, do you not want to go there? But obviously, if Pisces is still capable of operating as an independent agency, there's tons of stuff that the British Empire and Secret Services are getting up to that would be a really fun sidelight to talk about. I mean,
well, you might know something about.
One or two things, yeah. I can finally use all the Aiden research that wouldn't fit into Dracula, no matter how much.
We have 5 minutes left.
Easter Terrorist latest edition was great. Some really nice extra bits in there. Is there a campaign?
Oh, yes. Worldbreaker. I just got back the playtest notes for, and I hope to turn them back around into to Palgrain by before I take my Christmas break. In an odd sequence of events, the book has already been proofread. So just require the proofreading to whatever changes I make. So actually, it's further ahead than it looks. And that's Chris Hoof is doing the art direction and a lot of the art and layout for that. So that'll be sort of independent of the general production stream. So that should be able to come on pretty quickly.
Yeah, hoping to have that out by Gen Con.
Yes.
Last year, you mooted the idea of a Palgrain-specific convention.
International Palgrain Day. Well, I think Kat has been finally persuaded after a lot of whiskey that it's actually a really, really good idea.
Yeah, I think that's a very fair assessment of how that went.
But now that you're sober, what do you think, International Palgrain Day?
Yeah, I think so. It's because of the next year is the 10th anniversary, as we mentioned, of Gumshoe. So it seems kind of fitting to do some kind of celebration of Gumshoe.
Probably
kind
in October.
Probably in October-ish. Were we talking about it?
It could be my birthday, October 14th.
Oh.
So we'll all be either physically present in different locations,
yeah.
Running games or running games online or.
I keep trying to get you to Toronto, if that's what it takes.
Yeah, I can go up to Toronto.
To talk about the purse strings.
Yeah. More whiskey. And on that note, I think we've run out of time. So thanks everybody for coming, and enjoy your gaming experience and enjoy your Pelgrane games. Thanks, guys.